Katie.
Patrick.
Welcome back.
Thanks. It's good to be back in the Big Apple. It's a beautiful September day. Unfortunately, I always think of September 11th on this kind of weather, but I'm trying to push that out of my mind and just recognize that we are blessed in September. It's the season's bounty.
It is. It's when all the food was supposed to ripen, yep. So push you through the winter to get to the next spring when
exactly
food came
right.
again.
Yeah, yeah. So we actually went up to, we were in Easton, Connecticut on Saturday, my friend Curtis and I. And it's a beautiful area that is really close to Fairfield, so which is all suburban-y. And then a few miles east or west of that, is Easton, which is all farms. And there was one beautiful farm after another and all this beautiful produce happening all at once. They've got all their stone fruits in. They've got all their corn in. They're still doing tomatoes like mad. It was really sweet. And we went to a fun animal farm called the Silverman's Family Farm, where the Rhode Island Red Chickens were being harassed.
By who? The Jersey Giants?
Yeah, something like that. They had some other they had some other kind of chicken that we actually saw these white chickens jumping on the backs of the Rhode Island Reds and furiously pulling their feathers out.
When will the rare breeds of this country understand that the only way to advance their cause is by working together?
I don't know, Patrick, but I know that you're working hard on making that happen.
Well, read our sponsor. It's the first time ever. He is an integral part, genetically and spiritually, to the business.
Absolutely. Today's show, The Main Course, on Heritage Radio Network, is sponsored by Sutton Place Frame Shop, located at 998 First Avenue in New York. And you can visit their website at www.suttonplaceframe.com. This is a third-generation family-owned business.
I'd like to say 10th. To build the drama up, but I think third is probably more realistic.
I love the idea of just stretching it a little bit, though. I thoroughly endorse that. And, of course, we have special connections to the Sutton Place Frame Shop through the personage of our dear Heather Hyman.
That's true. Thank you for separating that. I wouldn't have wanted there to be a mix-up, you know, that we hadn't announced that on air.
Yeah, no, I think we have to. Full disclosure is always best.
Very important.
Absolutely. So my name is Katie Kiefer, and I'm sitting here with Patrick Martins on The Main Course. It is Labor Day weekend, and we have a really fantastic guest today who's going to join us for most of the hour. Steve Jenkins from Fairway is going to be coming in to shoot the breeze with us about all things olive oil, what Fairway is doing new trends in ingredients, what Fairway is doing in support of local ag, what they do about fish, what they do about meat. Basically, we're just going to take him apart and put him back together again.
So tell me everything that you did from beginning to end in under a minute in detail. Just kidding. We have 10 minutes.
Yeah, no. Well, or maybe not.
Where did you go? Where was the bulk of your time?
The bulk of my time was spent in my family home in Wakefield, Rhode Island. And not only do I love to be in Rhode Island, because, of course, I still have lots of friends and family there, but Rhode Island is becoming sort of a hotbed of interesting agricultural trends and businesses.
Fish-related?
Fish, lots and lots of aquaculture going on there in the shellfish department. There's at least 6 or 8 oyster fisheries, most notably one run by a guy named Perry Rosso, who now has a restaurant called the Matunic Oyster Bar. But he has his own Matunics. They're called Matunics. He has his own shellfish in Potter's Pond. And then all up and down that southern coast of Rhode Island, there are probably 6 or 8 other oyster fisheries that are working just like Perry is to try to clean up the waters and to bring back aquaculture to the Rhode Island seacoast. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I noticed that has never been before is that we've always had a lot of farmers markets in Rhode Island, but many of our markets are now supplying beef, which is a brand new thing.
Raised in Rhode Island?
They're all raised right in the area, right around the southern Rhode Island area. Newport's got a few farms, Saunderstown, Jamestown, and southern South County, where I'm from, also has a lot of farms that are raising their own cattle. The only problem that they have, and this is a problem that's endemic to the Northeast, is a lack of slaughtering and processing facilities. And they have one packer in Westerly who, I'm sorry to say, needs to take a trip up to Fleischer's in Kingston and get a lesson on how to take a cow apart, because we bought beef that was, to me, unrecognizable despite my many years in the butchering industry. I mean, I just didn't know what I was buying. And I was not surprised to find that it was practically inedible. I mean, there was just no form in which it could have been cooked that would have made it better. Yeah. So the fine art of processing and butchering beef has yet to follow this trend of raising their own cattle. But it was really nice to see see all of this farm business really pushing forward in Rhode Island, which has the second highest unemployment rate in the United States behind Michigan. So, you know, the state overall.
Whose fault is that?
It has a lot to do with the loss of manufacturing in Rhode Island. Rhode Island used to be a big textile and jewelry manufacturing base, as well as having a pretty strong fishing industry. The fish started going away in the 80s, I'd say, through overfishing on George's Bank off of Massachusetts, which was where most of the fish native to New England breed. And because those fisheries were overfished in the 70s and 80s, it's been very hard to bring them back. And a lot of Rhode Island fishermen went out of business because of that. Mm. And then on top of that was the loss of the manufacturing bases in those two industries of textiles and jewelry, much of which has been outsourced to you know, third world countries where the labor is a lot cheaper. So all of those things have combined to make Rhode Island really a hard scrabble state right now and really struggling. In fact, they're going to be shutting the government down for 10 days this fall. Mm. To save on expenses. I mean,
it's like
you imagine?
Medieval times.
It is. It's wild. And yet at the same time, you know, the service part of the industry in the state, the tourism is really thriving, and it's a great place to go visit. I mean, it is a beautiful state. It has all of the things that you want to do on vacation. There's boating, there's fishing, there's beautiful beaches, there's beautiful hiking.
Amusement parks?
Nature, we got that.
What's your most famous roller coaster?
I don't know the name of it, but there was this thing called the Rocky Point Amusement. Yeah, Rocky Point Amusement Park, for which I have very mixed feelings.
Why? What happened?
Well, that was my first roller coaster ride.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you were swindled by a carny or something.
No, I wasn't. But actually, I was part of this really interesting experience. I think I was about maybe 10 or 11. And I had this friend whose mom was a real, you know, socially conscious do-gooder type. And she organized for us to participate in a program to bring children from mentally disabled children from the local basically warehouse to the amusement park for a day of fun. And so we were each assigned our own child, and I had this child with Down syndrome named Brian. You know, I can remember this like really as if it happened yesterday, because it was just etched in horror in my memory. So the first thing that happened is we get to the lunch, the cafeteria at the amusement park, and we're being given clam cakes and clam chowder and watermelon. This is, you know, the usual fare for Rhode Island. We all have that, you know, whole seafood thing happening there. And so this child proceeded to eat about three plates of clam cakes and bowl after bowl of clam chowder, and eventually the watermelon is served. And when he was on maybe his ninth or tenth piece of watermelon, one of the attendants came over to give him his medication and said to me, "Oh, by the way, if you think he's eating too much, make him stop, because he doesn't know." At this point, I was looking at him. I thought, "My God, this child is going to explode right in front of me." But I was too scared to say anything, because I was only about 10 myself. And then it just kind of deteriorated from there. Oh, I mean, Lord. I had no training. And in those days, you know, working with mentally challenged children, you know, things have come a long way. And this child was not particularly well socialized, and he was heavily medicated. And his medication wore off towards the end of the day, and he became quite rambunctious. And eventually he stole a woman's stroller with the baby in it and began running furiously around the park with this little baby screaming his head off. And the mother absolutely, I mean, you can imagine now that I'm a mother. I mean, she sounded like a fire engine. I mean, it was a scene of the most incredible pandemonium.
Was this
horror.
The same day?
Yes, it was all the same day. I mean, I won't even tell you the many, many incidents in between.
Oh, Lord.
You can see why I remember this so well, in spite of the fact that it was like almost 50, no, 40-something years ago.
Oh my God.
Anyway,
that
so that was one of the first and last times that I ever went to an amusement park, because they just conjured up that whole scene for me. When he stole the baby, that was just
that was really
an incredible experience. So yes, and then he was, you know, given more medication. They were feeding those kids Thorazine.
Well, listen, if you go all throughout history without ever having a single drug to give other than whiskey, you know, or mushrooms or something, and then you get them, I would imagine it would get abused.
Oh, I think it was a great boon to anybody who, you know, but I mean, the whole sort of mental health profession has gone through such an incredible change in the last 25 or 30 years. Thank goodness. Mm-hmm. So anyway, but what else did I do? Well, I swam a lot. Some in the ocean, yep, and some in the freshwater lake right near my house. In fact, mostly that. I did that almost every day.
What's the longest you can swim?
Oh, I can swim for hours. You mean in terms of distance?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Could you reach
really
the landmass east of us?
Oh, easily, yeah. Because I can swim
Elba?
Almost indefinitely.
Island of Elba?
Yeah, probably.
Wow.
Sure, absolutely.
If the weather's were calm.
If the water is calm, yeah. There's really no, I don't lose strength in the water. I can just stay afloat for a long, long time.
Do you ever
time.
Have to rest and turn upside down? And
sure,
just...
I rest. Mm-hmm. And tread water, or just I do this like nice little easygoing breaststroke, and then when I'm feeling very vigorous, then I do the crawl for like a really long time until
wow.
I run out of gas on that. But yeah, I can stay. I mean, what happens is somebody will get in the canoe, and I'll just swim along next to the canoe all around while we talk.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, it's really nice. But what did you do? I mean, you guys had some great shows. I was
did
really sad
this,
to miss some of them.
A farm on every floor.
Well,
op-ed
not only did I see it by Despommiers.
Despommiers?
Yes, I've actually contacted Professor Despommiers several times. I saved that in my computer. And I'm hoping very much that he's on vacation, and that's why he hasn't responded to me yet. But
there's
I
a
do...
high-rise drawn on the op-ed, and on the first floor is corn, then beans, then beets, then peas.
Yeah, and this is all grown mostly, well, hydroponically, meaning no need for soil, which means no need for fertilizing chemicals, and very little need for any kind of pesticides. And if it's not hydroponic, then it's aeroponic, where it's just grown with a watery mist.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what's interesting about this is that... as I think I mentioned to you when I sent you the link to that article a few weeks ago when it came out, I worked on a book called The Meaning of the 21st Century about 5 years ago when I was doing publicity for books by an English futurist named Dr. James Martin, who predicted exactly this model and went way beyond it, actually. He had a very complex analysis for where agriculture should be heading. Mm-hmm. This is a guy who wrote The Wired World and The Wired Society. So he predicted the rise of the internet, the use of the cell phone, and so forth, long before any of these inventions had even really been happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I was curious to see if Dr. Despommiers had also read The Meaning of the 21st Century or was friends with Dr. Martin, because it was just so close an interaction in terms of those two ideas. But this is all for urban agriculture, as opposed to having all of our agriculture take place out in the center of the country and then having to truck it. You would be growing your food close to where everybody is going to actually be using it.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's the beauty of this model. It's not just that it cuts down on the excessive land use, which is our current agricultural model, but it's also, it keeps agriculture close to where the people are who need to be using it.
Yeah, I'm amazed that like just one of these don't exist. You know what I mean? Everyone talks.
Well,
There are. No,
but he has a company and he's working very hard, I think.
To lobby to get someone
to
allow.
Yeah, to get somebody to fund this.
It should be a government-funded thing.
Well, we hope that's what's going
to
happen.
Because that's not a bad investment, is to create a model that then people can do in every abandoned four-story house in America.
But why wouldn't somebody like George Soros or Warren Buffett want to invest in
or
something
Or for that
like
matter,
this?
The slaughterhouses. I mean, those guys probably have meat 2 times a day for their whole life, or 1 time a day their whole life. And yet the tiniest little investment in a little cinder block hut 50 miles north of New York, and run by maybe, if no one has flocked to it now, Michael Batterbury has a really interesting project that I think he's worked on with Gus Schumacher called The New American Farmer, where they would get, families from the Philippines or Vietnam to move to like outside Boston or someplace in Massachusetts and work the land, growing their own vegetables, but also providing a real anchor to markets and all that with fresh produce. Maybe the answer is not in... I don't know, traditional ways of thinking.
I think the answer is definitely not in traditional ways of thinking, because we can see what traditional ways of thinking have brought us, which is mega agribusiness, excessive land waste, dust bowl potentiality. And I think we're going to be taking a break right now.
But this is very, very interesting. And
hope to get this professor onto the show in the next coming weeks. I'm looking forward to chatting with him. So
that's
stay
fantastic.
Tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned.
Yeah. We're back.
My, how the studio dynamic has changed.
Absolutely. We're joined in the studio today on the main course on Heritage Radio Network. We're sponsored by
Sutton Place Frame Shop. Absolutely. 998 First Avenue at 55th Street. Their phone number is 212-355-3840. Don't trust your documents to just any framer. Go to Sutton Place Frame Shop.
Absolutely. And today on the main course, we have with us Steve Jenkins of Fairway Market. Steve and...
He's a hero. We need a sound effect. Yeah. You're on sound effects today.
Oh.
Applause. Also here, if you could grab right next to you, there's a piece of paper right next to you, behind you actually, with all the sound effects.
Yeah, well, I just
Steve
failed.
Definitely
I
deserves
failed on
applause.
That one. I'll have to do it the next time. Okay. But anyway, Steve is a hero. Steve has been in the business for longer than just about any of us. It's probably, well, I won't say longer than you've been alive, Patrick, but...
Well, no, right there. But what I love it is, you know...
getting close, probably.
There always seem to be certain people, certainly like philosophers, that covered so much. And then all the people that followed did some element, some aspect of what was originally done, you know? And
that's right.
I think it's so funny to talk to some of these young people who think they're so globalized in their little local situation. Then you see a guy like Steve where they're just like, oh my God.
Well, and who not only that was opening up markets and bringing in products that nobody had ever heard of or thought about in the United States.
Creating a bridge of cheeses and olive oils and stuff to America. I mean, to be in the first generation to do that is pretty intense.
Yeah. And the last time Steve was on the show, we actually talked about that history. And today I thought it would be fun to talk about what's happening at Fairway today. First of all, I wanted to, thanks very much for coming in, by the way, Steve. I wanted to talk about your olive
oils.
Steve,
you're not going to get to talk, by the way, this hour.
Yeah, because
so
I'm
you
just
know.
A little, yeah, I'm a little ratcheted up here. But let's talk first about your olive oil business, because you've sort of segued out of cheese and into olive oil in a way that I don't think most people are really kind of digging on at the Fairway. Even though when you go to Fairway, you see a huge display of fabulous olive oils. Tell us a little bit about how you got that source going and what brought you, you know, into that market as opposed to, I don't know, something else.
I remember back in the 70s when we were just beginning to get into serious food, serious artisanal food. And while I was a cheesemonger then, I was also responsible for stuff that was on the shelves. And I realized that even though I was really young and hadn't traveled much and didn't have much experience, I realized that the olive oil that we had was all phony baloney. There was no real serious olive oil in the city up until 1979.
I think that's true. I only remember ever seeing Burio. I think was about the
yeah,
only.
Yeah, and that was just totally.
It was Dreck.
Dreck. It was just, like Miller beer or yeah. Budweiser.
Right. No real flavor, no smell.
Nothing. There was no extra virgin oil in the city. The ones that purported to be were the Louis de Régie French oil in a real pretty little tin with a really pretty label, one of those old little deco sort of labels. And then there was James Plagnol.
That's right.
A French oil that came in a bottle that looked like hair tonic. So it looked really cool
small.
In your kitchen.
Yeah, right.
It looked like you knew what you were doing if you had a bottle of James Plagnol in the kitchen. But it was absolutely phony olive oil that didn't even come from France and was certainly not extra virgin.
Right.
Was it American?
Well, then there was Badia e Coltimono. It came in from...
The other one was Hilaire Fabre, F-A-B-R-E.
I remember that.
And it also came in a really pretty little bottle with a real sort of a floral label and with filigree and rock cocoa, and it was completely phony too. And those were the three oils. And then Leo Shaw shows up at the Pasta and Cheese at 72nd and Madison with these big ass square bottles of Badia e Coltimono, which came from this couple that had one of those snobby Chiantis from the Chianti region of Tuscany, and they grew olive trees cheek by jowl with their wonderful Sangiovese wine vines, from which they derived their famous Badia e Coltimono olive oil. And this woman made her name because she was a de' Medici.
Wow.
And she liked everyone to think that she was like a direct descendant of Cosimo de' Medici.
I always use that whenever someone like helps Heritage out or the Heritage Radio Network, I call them Medicis. I use that word twice
that's
a day.
Excellent, Patrick.
But it turned out, as so They're many important. Tuscan things do, that that was a complete bunch of smoke. The closest she got to de' Medici was the last five letters of her name. and he was a big blowhard. And they brought this olive oil in, and it was being sold by a wine salesman for Frederick Wildman, Leo Shaw,
no
who
kidding.
Was a wonderful man. And they could get whatever they wanted to get for it. And that was the very beginning
they
of
were the
Tuscan
only game in town.
Ethnocentrism, snobbery out of Tuscans.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of a long roller coaster ride with the Tuscans, making everybody in New York believe that anything Tuscan was the best there is, and that Tuscans were just better than everybody else.
Are you saying they're not?
Uh-huh, yeah, I am.
But they also think that in Italy. I mean, every region thinks they are the best.
Not
but I mean,
the way Tuscans do.
Yeah, there's a certain arrogance. Well, that's also where the Italian language came from. Like, it was their version of it that ended up being the national.
There's an argument for that, I suppose. But from our standpoint, they've been ripping us off for years with their wines and their olive oils and the rest of their nonsense because they've got, Florence and Siena and wonderful places to visit.
Yeah,
so they've parlayed it. You got to hand it to them. They've parlayed
it. Products are good.
They're good,
the best,
but they're not any better than Umbrian or Roman
or
Sicilian. No better. It's just that those other people are more down to earth and less horn tooting than the Tuscans.
Well,
that was the beginning of olive oil.
Barbera Sicilian.
I brought this not for you, Patrick, because you know you can get it out of me without any trouble. I brought that for the chef here at Roberta's just to pay our respects, Sarah Black's and my respects.
Why did
chef.
You bring this one in particular? I mean, what
well,
is
Well, that's one of my 14 barrel oils. I bring in 14 different families' oils from Spain and France and Italy and Australia and Mexico that thrill me, that absolutely thrill me, so that I can have it not filtered.
Uh-huh.
And that I can pump it myself up at the Harlem store and the Harlem Fairway and put it in my own cheap bottle with my own label that I've written. Everything there is to know about that olive oil on that label.
Right.
And that's something that you can't get anywhere else but Fairway is an olive oil that tells you everything there is to know about the
Let's
oil.
Read a little segment. This unfiltered oil from Western Sicily is cold pressed from Biancolilla olives. It is wonderfully fragrant with an unctuous and creamy texture. Its flavor is immense, complex.
I like that.
Dried fruit, hazelnut, black peppercorns. It is provided exclusively for Fairway by Manfredi Barbera, whose Frantoio, Stupor Mundi, and Barbera Organic labels are among our most famous and popular olive oils.
We use a lot of Frantoio olive oil in our Recession Cooking Series.
And here, listen to this.
Yeah, you know this brand.
Yeah.
These olives were harvested past February. I've always loved Fairway's ability to move stuff, much product that they can, you know, make these claims. The oil's acidity measured less than 0.5%.
Beauty. Beauty.
I mean, that's cool to be able to derive that information from something you're spending. And that's the other thing. That would cost three times what I charge for it if it was in Manfredi's own bottle with Manfredi's label and Manfredi's boat that brought it across the Atlantic. That price would be inflated three times what I get for it. So it's not only the best oil there is, it's a steal.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Very, very good.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, I wanted to ask you one more question. Like, in terms of your relationships, like with your meat and fish purveyors and finding new things. Like, are you just recycling old ideas? I mean, how do you come up with new things to show the millions that come through your store?
Let's expand on that for a second, because it's fair. I was talking to somebody else who owned a sort of gourmet food store, and he's been in the business for about 30 years, a guy from Wilton, Connecticut. And I said, how do you stay on top of the trends? Like, how do you, because you really have to set the trends. In a lot of ways, you know, you have to stay on top of whatever cuisine is hot at that moment and provide those ingredients. And how do you guys how do you push those trends forward to help you capitalize on the products that you find?
John Rossi and me and Sarah Black, we've never thought in terms of what's happening. We think in terms of what thrills us. I mean, we don't follow trends. We set trends. I don't mean to brag, but
that's sort of what I think.
We get around. We go to our friend Tim and Dagny's joint in Italy, and we move around.
Like the ciabatta? Is that a trend that got started by someone?
Sarah Black, who's sitting in front of us here, invented the ciabatta. She got a half a page in the New York Times for it, I don't know, 15 years ago?
Really? Tell us about it, Sarah.
Well, it's true that I came to bread making from paper making, and paper making is a craft that uses a lot of water. So I was familiar with breads and doughs that were water-based and started experimenting, reading Carol Fields' book.
Carol's a good
I love Carol Fields, yeah.
She lives out in San Francisco, right?
Yeah. In Nonna's Kitchen. She's a really great baker, and she's written a lot of cookbooks. Yeah.
Inspirational. And started experimenting, and thank goodness for Steve Jenkins, who I believe had my bread at a store in Manhattan and has been a follower ever since and really made my business grow after the New York Times article and kind of brought me back to Fairway, where we're making great ciabatta again.
And rye bread and sourdough bread and all kinds of whole wheat, whole grain breads and all kinds of pastries.
But let's go back to this trend thing of you guys setting the trends, because the thing that interests me about the way, you know, cooking flows, you know, like one season it's going to be all about salumeria and another season it's going to be all about, right now everybody's all in love with mastering the art of French cooking again, for instance, you know. So sometimes trends are influenced by external things like a book or a movie that sells a lot of copies or a lot of tickets. But sometimes it's more subtle than that. Like, for instance, when lemongrass suddenly became ubiquitous in every market. Like, when did everybody figure out that when did you guys know that it was time to start selling lemongrass? Or why did you decide that? I mean, it doesn't have to be.
Katie, you're a hipster. You're one of my customers for all these years.
Yes, I have been.
And you're a hipster, and you know what it is you want. We listen to what it is you want, and we respond. You pick something up, or in your travels you came across some piece of charcuterie or some spice like Aleppo pepper or indeed lemongrass or something. You said, Steve, where is it? And I go, it'll be here in a couple of days. So we don't think in terms of trends and things that are happening. And I don't mean me and Sarah. I mean you too as a shopper. You don't think like that. You think in terms of what am I going to put on the table tonight? What's available to me? What looks good? what gets me going, what particular cuisine gets me going. And knowing you, it's a Mediterranean thing. And like for us, it's always a Mediterranean thing.
The trends are kind of like side effects anyway. Like, for instance, the artisanal cheese movement in the United States that started in the past 30 years because of these ambassadors that Steve first brought over.
Right.
It wasn't a trend that was consciously set at that, but it had that effect.
That's what I'm trying to say. It's not a conscious thing that you're doing, lurching from one fashion to another.
Right.
We like the old ways. We like everything the old style. We like the old tools, the old ingredients.
That
the
used
people
to be
that
a
produce
nonprofit.
The stuff for generations, the specific regions that they come from. We turn a complete blind eye to country, and I harp on this all the time. We don't think in terms of France or Italy or Spain or Belgium. We think in terms of Flanders. We think in terms of Catalonia.
Uh-huh.
We think of the Ardèche and Aveyron, and we think of Le Marche and Abruzzi. We don't think of Italy.
Right, right.
So we travel. We don't go to some dopey Caribbean island and lie on a beach and drink cheap beer with lime slices in it.
Oh,
we get on a damn airplane and we go to Europe, someplace that we haven't been before, and we roam around in a car or on a bicycle or on foot around obscure parts of the Mediterranean basin.
Hmm. Right.
That's what gets us going. And that's why Tim and Dagny are here. They've got a place on Monte Argentario that is a paradise. It's an hour north of Rome, and it's contiguous to all the little Etruscan hill towns that you can wander around. And you're right next to the greatest salumi in the world, which is Umbria.
Right.
Norcia. I mean, they used to call a great shop for salumi a Norcelleria, named after a town in Umbria. Mm. So that, you know, we like the old stuff.
Yeah.
We don't like trend.
But what do you think about the new cheese movement, though? I mean, are there cheeses that are equal?
I just got back from Austin, where we had our annual competition. There were 650 entries from North America, most American. A few of them were Canadian. A couple of them were Mexican. And it was 127 degrees in Austin, and we all got together, and we had all these people at their expense send us their cheeses. And we had a slew of judges that were aesthetic, and some were technical. And we parsed every bloody cheese they sent to us.
Wow, 600-something entries.
And I'm telling you, we make the most extraordinary cheese in the world in this and on this continent.
Really?
Without fail. And you know me, I've been,
you've been
elbow deep
thing.
In European cheeses for 35 years. 37 years. 75 to now is 34, 35 years. And we make the greatest cheese in the world in this country.
Hmm. Who was the competition winner?
It was won this year by the Rogue River Blue, my friend David Gremmel and Carrie.
Oh, great.
Who live in the Rogue River Valley way down south below Eugene.
Yeah.
They make the most magnificent raw cow's milk blue cheese that I've ever tasted in my career.
We had Dave
I've been
show.
Around.
Patrick.
That's very impressive. What's that?
We had Dave on the show when we did the Javits Center. The
bless
the
your
yeah.
Well,
yeah.
What about talking about blue? Maytag blue. Are you friends? He was one of the real.
But that's old hat. Maytag blue is real passe old hat, and it's made by people who've really sort of turned their back on what they're doing. It's
really?
Gotten soapy.
Has it?
It's gotten soapy. I think the texture's really
soapy's
gone down.
A good word.
It, you know, 15 years ago, Maytag was happening when Fritz Maytag was paying attention to it. Well, that's not true. He never paid attention to it. I've been to their creamery.
But that
don't
does
spare anyone's
it
feelings.
Speaks up. It does.
Fritz Maytag is the scion of the Maytag appliance company that's in the middle of nowhere, Iowa.
Yeah.
And he gave them the money to use
this,
all of the
I
milk
see.
That they couldn't get rid of from their herd of prize cattle that they would enter in the Iowa State Fair every year. They just had too much milk.
Right.
So he put
it. But
let
me ask, has someone been doing it? Like, is it within the artisanal food world, be it Anchor Steam or, I mean, I don't even know. I just know they've been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. 50, 60 years.
That's
like
Fritz
when
Anchor
you broke Steam. Into, when you broke into the business, people who have, were already doing it and have maintained it, be it, you know, in whatever craft of the food world. I mean, are there those 100-year families in the food world?
Without
still
question,
producing.
There is. In fact, David Gremmels, it was here, the people that make he and Carrie that make the Rogue River Blue, which is the most drop-dead edible substance on the face of the earth besides Iberico ham, I might say. Very expensive, but it's absolutely staggeringly delicious. David bought that creamery from Ignazio Vella, who's one of the great 150-year-old families of California that invented Monterey Jack, invented Dry Jack.
The Italian Parmesan, American Parmesan.
The American Parmigiano, exactly right. And he bought the creamery and kept the tradition going, and Ig still visits him. And Ig's dad just died at 97, and Ig's way up there now, but he still comes and visits the creamery. He constantly wears a little hat that makes him look like an ice cream cone vendor. And that cheese, that Rogue River Blue that won the competition Best of Show, was Supreme Champion this year in Austin, is an outgrowth of Ig Vella. So, yeah, we have a tremendous tradition, but it's like the one in Catalonia. It's like the way all these young people have spurned the notion of working in a cubicle for their entire lives. Uh-huh. And they said, the hell with it, Mom. The heck with it, Dad. I'm moving out in the country. And they go out in the country outside of Barcelona into that paradise of Catalonia. And they create foodstuffs and make a meaningful stab at making enough money selling food to raise a family. Mm-hmm. And that's what all these people in America are doing. They're saying, I don't want to work some boring job. Yeah. I want to go make cheese. And they're doing it. And the evidence is that we had 650 of them in a down economy.
Pretty amazing.
At their expense, come to Austin, Texas, where it's 147 degrees, in order to show everybody how proud they are.
Didn't they read the Farmer's Almanac before choosing the date?
We didn't have a choice. We chose that because, I don't know, there's all those whole foodies down there, and they gave us a bunch of money to...
You're doing a great job on the sound effects board, by the way, Katie. So you're always like, by the time you find it, you're like, never mind.
I gave up.
Well, we should take a let's take a 1 minute break, and then we'll come back and talk more with Steve and the other guests in the studio.
We're back. It's The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network with your hosts, Patrick Martins.
That's me.
And Katie Kiefer. And today in the studio, we have Steve Jenkins of Fairway and Sarah Black, a baker and you're a buyer for Fairway also, right?
I'm the director of the bakery.
Okay, and thank you for the actual title. Yeah, it didn't have the right title there. We are sponsored today by the wonderful organization of
Sutton Place Frame Shop.
Thank you.
Don't trust your important documents. I mean, you pay $800,000 to get your kid to college, and then you're not going to spend $60 on a friggin' frame.
Yeah, and a good one. Yeah, there you go. So anyway, Steve, we were talking about all things fairway, all things olive oil, all things artisanal, and the things that matter to you. And you guys brought up the New Amsterdam Market. So let's kick it off with that, because that's news to me, and it sounds like a really exciting new organization that's growing up on presumably the West Side. Or is it just citywide? Oh, yeah, right. Actually, I read about this.
You know what we're talking about.
I read about this in Local Gourmands, to tell you the truth, in that lovely little newsletter. Yeah. So give us a whole rundown on that. Sarah, you, I guess, were the one who connected Steve with the New Amsterdam Market. So why don't you start off with how you came across this organization and what drew you to it?
Last year, they held a market, and Jim Leahy of Sullivan Street organized a lot of bread bakers to present their wares. And I attended and just fell in love with the whole setup, the number of purveyors, the product quality, and got involved with the director, said, you know, I want to do what I can. And when I came on with Fairway, spoke with Steve about fundraising, and then luckily was able to bring Fairway on as one of their lead sponsors.
Fantastic.
The market will be September 13th, next Sunday. And they have 80 purveyors signed up. They're booked.
That's the opening of this market, and then it will be an ongoing thing.
We hope it will be an ongoing thing, but it will be happening, I believe, 4 dates throughout the year.
Uh-huh.
And you can go to their website, newamsterdammarket.org, to find out more information.
Absolutely. So that kicks off next Sunday?
Next Sunday,
with
September 13th.
With 80 purveyors in all different disciplines, not just bakers, but there's going to be cheesemakers, mm-hmm. olive oils. Mm-hmm. I mean, the gamut of gourmet fine food.
Saxelby Cheesemongers will be there.
Excellent.
And Saxelby. She's so terrific.
She is so terrific. Yes, we can all do. If I had the sound effect thing down, I'd be doing one for her,
but
I don't.
At least you mentioned it. At least you talked about it. It's existence.
We ought to have a smackdown, Anne and me. On
and then
the
Steve
time.
Will get on sound effects.
Definitely. That would be fun. Yeah. That would be a lot of fun.
This is going to be a place for kind of smackdowns and mud wrestling. And there's a bikini contest, bikini keg contest at 6 o'clock here at Roberta. So
any
I'm counting
trannies?
On everyone here to stay for that. No, there could be some trannies, but there are going to be 3 bands playing. So if you're in the neighborhood, come down to Roberta's.
Trannies
for sure.
And bikinis,
did you
that
ask
turns me? On.
I was just going to say, did you say trannies?
There's a sound effect for that.
Yeah, really. I think it's called speechless.
So, can I ask you back to the olive oil question? Are you going to? Do you sell this outside of your store? I mean, is your goal to see like McDonald's use this olive oil and to produce so much, or that wasn't its intention?
No, we've never wholesaled a dram. It's all for the stores. Mm-hmm. In addition to all the olive oils that I import direct in the bottles of the guys and gals that produce the stuff, I also sell a whole lot of stuff that I buy locally. Mm-hmm. But these are my barrel oils. There's 14 of them. And they're a joy because they're fresher, they're unfiltered, and the price is like a third of what it should
right.
be.
Right, yeah.
And now people can buy this in Paramus. How is that mm-hmm. store going? I mean, have you guys got it down on how to open a massive store? Or, I mean, can you make rules, or is each store opening so different that...
It's no different from the Plainview store. You know, when you get out of Harlem and Upper West Side and Red Hook, Brooklyn, things change, and they change really fast. And you know, I'm not gonna turn my nose up at the burbs, because we've got some great stores there. I don't feel comfortable on Long Island, and I don't feel comfortable in Paramus, and I'm out there every day, you know, making this store as good as it can be. But that's not my crowd. Those are not my people.
But you want them to be your people, Steve.
Why would I want them to be my people?
Because you want them to patronize your store, man.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean that we have to be like people.
No.
But maybe they just haven't had good food.
Yeah, they haven't
had the opportunity. Maybe they'll open up right away.
Exactly.
Maybe.
I mean, there's got to be ways of making, you know, something like this exciting, you know, like your Sicilian olive oil here, exciting and meaningful to the Paramus market. I mean, I think it's possible.
What?
People just need the information. They just need to know it's there, and they need somebody to show them the way and say, hey, this is incredibly good. It's one-third the cost it would be anywhere else, and you can drizzle it on your steamed vegetables or make pasta agli olio or or pour a little as a condiment on your fish or grill or whatever. And you know, they want to do it. People want to do the right thing.
I thought this Paramus...
look at him. He's
I mentioned the Paramus store.
He's visibly deflating as
turn.
I say this.
When you when you get out of New York City and you have more than three stores, it's, you know, suddenly it's work.
Are you born and raised here in the city?
I moved here out of college. I was in Columbia, Missouri for 23 years and went to school there. And I moved here and I've been here ever since. That was 35, 36 years ago.
You still go back?
No.
No.
No. I don't want to go back there.
You maybe you'd see that third grade teacher you had a crush on.
No. We just had my 40th high school reunion, and I didn't go. And one of my oldest friends just came to town and emails me, and I didn't answer the email till he left town.
Ooh, that's harsh, Steve.
Ted Pettit showed up in town, and I just totally blew him off.
Ooh.
I don't want to see those people anymore. I just don't care.
I hear what you're saying.
Wow. I think it's always good to stay in touch with where you came from.
There's a sound effect we have for that.
You usually have the sound effects going. What's up with that?
Because they're in front of me instead of in front of Patrick.
I just moved the studio.
I don't really understand how to use the board, and I didn't have time to experiment.
By the way, I should say this might have been the greatest engineering and producing feat in the history of radio, coming in 20 minutes before showtime and seeing
completely revamping the studio. Yeah. Yeah.
So great job. Thanks. That's Jack Inslee, the producer, and Nat Wiener, the engineer. Both NYU grads last year.
Real smart. Yep.
My son's an NYU grad.
Oh, really?
My boy Max.
What did he major in?
He got the acting award when he graduated last year.
And you were you are a thespian.
I was
in every
back in the 70s.
Word you say. But did you act on television and movies?
Yeah, I did all that stuff for at least 3 years.
Oof. Three soul destroying years.
Long
where you got to mouth commercials.
It was like Kramer.
Feel like you were really
Kramer
hot.
And Seinfeld, who went to LA for
after
a very
after 3 years
time.
Of looking for work and auditioning and going through
and
that beating, I got
tell
a job
you.
In a cheese shop, and that was the end of that. No, but
you
my,
and
boy
everybody
Max,
else
my boy Max just got cast in a Tom Selleck CBS thing.
Sweet. Yeah. Oh, that's real money.
Tom Selleck was rated number one sexiest TV star male. In something I was watching with my friend last night.
I'm drinking that Kool-Aid. I love Tom Selleck.
What's
that's
a
good thing.
Q quotient. He's got a high Q quotient.
He
Q quotient.
He's got a cute mustache.
Q.
Always been a sucker for that.
That's right. Magnum PI was a good show. Well, that's a big star to be affiliated with. I mean, that's
huge,
a good chance that pilot's going to go or whatever.
Yeah, it's very exciting for the kid.
Yeah.
25 years old.
And what does he have a specific, or what role did you play? I mean, what did you have a stereotype?
I had a regular role on Love of Life.
I don't even remember that.
You don't remember Love of Life?
Love of Life. It
Is
was
that
a
soap opera?
Yeah, sure.
Love of Life.
Love
As the World
of
Turns,
Love
of Life,
yeah.
Secret Storm. You don't
remember
that?
I remember
you
those.
You people are so young. It's really weird, really whacked up.
No, Steve.
Hey, I was
a
regular on Love of Life, and I had a role in Woody Allen's Manhattan.
Really?
And I got paid for it.
I'm going to rent that right away.
No, I wouldn't. Well, it's a good movie.
It was a good movie.
That was back when the Hemingway girls were happening.
Yes, and that was back when Woody Allen was making movies I was actually interested in.
Come on.
Hasn't happened in a really long time.
You see Woody's photo now with Sun Yi, and you realize that time has passed.
Time has passed.
Yeah,
absolutely.
She's now drinking age.
Yes.
No, just kidding. Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Nice one, Patrick. Oh,
I'm a big fan of Woody Allen. I never made a bad joke about that ever, but I couldn't resist.
But let's go back to olive oils, and let's go. One of the things that you said earlier about the olive oils, your barrel oils, that interested me was that you're getting some from Mexico.
Yeah, how about
have
that?
Thought
how
of
cool
Mexico
is that?
As an olive oil producing country.
Isn't that terrific?
That is way cool.
Well,
now, is that something
climate,
you sort
a
of
hot
fought?
Climate, like
it makes
Sicily
total sense.
And all that, yeah.
The terroir
it's
a, is the
It's
right
100 and... clicks south of Ensenada, and they've got 2,700 trees, and it's all Picual, which is one of the three great Spanish olives.
How did you meet these people?
I found this oil because I deal with this woman who facilitates my egress to the Umbrian olive oil that is my store brand, is the Fairway.
Mm-hmm.
The Fairway label olive oil is Umbrian. It's a blend of Pugliese and Umbrian. But these Umbrians plant, well, it's because Taormina, this outfit called Taormina, has great olive holdings in California for food olives. Mm-hmm. And that grower bought some land in Baja and made a big grove out of it like 7 years ago. And the first batch of olives came out, were so sublime that they didn't cure them for food. They pressed them and they turned me on to it. And I said, this is as good as a lot of anything I've ever had.
Right.
And it was cheap as hell.
Yeah.
And I said, put it in barrels. Don't filter it. Send it to me immediately. 200 liter barrels. And I wrote it up, everything I knew about it and everything I smelled in it, what I tasted in it, where it grows, the variety of olive, blah, blah, blah. And it's been a big, huge success because...
Fabulous.
That reminds me, I would love to have Steve on one day just to talk about the words Americans use to describe taste.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's a very rich language in French and Italian. You have a wealth of options. In America, like he said, soapy for Maytag, that's it was perfect word mm-hmm. and not one that would be readily come
it to helps you. It helps you communicate. And I was thinking just yesterday how... The words that people use to communicate colors, like the interior of the Chelsea tractor, the seats are beige. But what kind of beige is it? It's really a creamy beige. You know, you use the word cream to elicit a response, not just from yourself, but to whoever is reading what you're writing or listening to what you're saying. For colors and for tastes, flavors, and scents, fragrances, there are words that work, and there are words that are hackneyed and
like
overused.
Mouthfeel, or like just I've never liked
for a cheese, that's my creamy. Most unfavorite creamy. Word. Mouthfeel really drives me right
like,
over
we've
the edge.
Gotta do better than that, people. Come on,
I don't mind mouthfeel, and you know me, I hate everything, but I don't mind mouthfeel.
We've got to come up with a better.
Too
I mean,
industrial.
Those are two words.
I don't. I like to divorce
together.
The industrial language from the language of food. I don't like the idea that
I agree
has
with
a-
you, but mouthfeel works for me. You've got to speak of a texture in terms of its the way it
the
feels,
way it feels
in, your
in your mouth.
It's not so bad.
I don't mind that.
I can think the word nubbin. I don't like that word.
Does that have anything to do with food?
Yeah, like a nubbin of butter.
Oh, what does that mean?
That reminds me of Elizabeth David, though. And I love I love reading what she writes.
Yeah,
a
no
pony of
it.
A pony glass
she's
of wine, a nubbin of butter. I
she's
love
one
that.
Of the great three, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely.
No question about it. So it's a matter of taste what it is you like. But you know, I hate everything and I won't defend much, but I'll defend mouthfeel.
So how can people learn more about what you do? Is there a bread section of the Fairway website, or how do people contact you, young bakers out there, or if they have questions or if they want to buy your breads?
We have bakeries at each of our store, and they're dedicated to these artisanal breads. The website is a work in progress. It's a little bit hard to contact me there, but...
It's fairway.com?
Is it Fairway...
Market. Fairwaymarket.com or stephen.jenkins.com, and I answer people all the time. Talk to us. If you have... You know, all of our listeners have got to consider me their personal grocer. Any food-related issue that comes up, anything you want to know about food... Anything you can't find, anything you want to talk about, I'm your man. Because if I don't know it, it's not worth knowing.
Okay. Well,
nice.
We didn't get our,
I like
our,
it.
Yeah, I love that. Our hour, unfortunately, is almost up, but we didn't get a chance to talk about how Fairway sources meat.
Yeah, you were
fish.
Really trying to get us to talk about that sourcing business. And
well,
I tried to get it across to you as we travel.
Yeah.
And we keep our eyes open and we don't leave any stone
we're
unturned.
Have
but
Steve
are you guys,
back.
Yeah,
we're
you'll be back,
Steve,
because
back.
What I wanted to, what if I was trying to get at there is how much is the sort of the heritage meats, the heritage breeds and that kind of stuff, how much is that able to
thanks for trying to promote
through.
The heritage foods
that,
business.
That comes absolutely. To a place where I make a decision where there's something I want to hump. I'm going to hump it, and it's going to be those
oh
great
my God.
Heritage
don't
turkeys.
Leave me alone
it's
going to with
be those
Steve.
Great heritage pigs.
Right.
And if it's something that I'm interested in.
Then you're going to promote it.
That,
you're going to bring it into the store and see how it does.
Exactly.
Because the real question with those things, and I know that we're almost out of time, but and that's why you got to come back and talk about it, is how we can make those heritage breeds and make those sort of more, if you will, esoteric animals, more accessible
to
the general public.
I'll tell you how you can do it. Can you do it by getting it in a market like ours that sells them at a fair price?
Yes.
And tells you this is the best thing you ever put in your mouth. That's
right. And makes the consumer willing to pay the extra cost that it takes to raise that kind of animal.
Exactly.
Fairway once had a very nice thing in the Fairway Brooklyn one. They said, Patrick Martin says this about this ham. And I was laughing with my friends, like, could anything mean anything less than
Patrick
Martin?
Oh, come on. You've got a name. People know your name.
No, I know. It's so funny they saw it. But it was very funny. It was very nice that you did that. We have very, very good shows coming up. Katie, you have organized some unbelievable shows. We have Sally Fallon, the head of the and founder of the Weston Price Foundation.
Yes.
Which is all about eating fats and all this nutritional work, like pork fat. Like, they support that. And they say, you know, they all live really long. Who else do we have? Ann Cooper?
We have Ann Cooper, who's going to be coming on, and Bill Talapan also.
This is all on the 20th.
Well, Ann Cooper is going to be coming on the 20th to talk about her program with Whole Foods to improve nutrition in schools across the country.
That's big.
And then in this month's Edible Manhattan, and I'll give a little plug to that, not just because I'm in it, but also because there's a wonderful article about what Bill Talapan is doing with Wellness in the Schools, as a group that has organized, what do you call it, sort of an outreach into the New York City school system where somebody like Bill can go into a school and actually train the staff to make better food and do like a top 10 list of things don't want to serve to children.
We love Bill Talapan.
Yeah, Bill is a great
West 67th
guy.
Street Talapan.
Yeah.
There's no better cook on the face of the earth
than
Bill Talapan.
And nobody who is more conscientious about where he gets his stuff and what he's doing with these school lunch programs is really remarkable.
To be fair, Katie only mentioned it mentioned him randomly because she wanted people to see her.
Yeah, that's right, because it's in this Edible
he
Manhattan.
He was just, no. Yeah, Bill's amazing.
For my recession cooking series. Let me just get that plug in there.
Do you have a website? Recessioncookingseries.com?
They can go to my partner, ericadomain.com, and we'll be starting up again on Tuesday, September 22nd. It's a cute little neighborhood deal, and we'll talk about it more at another time. But
we have
but
the
Bill
report.
Is going to come on. Ann Cooper. Andy Smith from the New School, who is a prolific food historian, who has a new book coming out from Columbia University Press on the 30 sort of major turning points in food manufacturing that have basically made us eat what we eat today.
Steve Jenkins is 26 and 27.
Yeah.
He's probably the three more recent.
We have No Impact Man coming on for the queue in a few
weeks.
He
survived.
That's October 4th.
With, like, all he had was a spoon, and he was in a biosphere by himself with nothing.
But then he sent out all his promotional materials by FedEx, so that was a little upsetting. Wow.
And then also exciting in the future, we have four new shows on the Heritage Radio Network, and two of those hosts are going to be on the next show to give us one's Hot Grease.
That's right.
And the other show that's going to get promoted is one about dating and the food scene. And this guy's not going to be here, but Bernie Wides has been working at the Natural History Museum for decades and is going to do a multi-part series covering two animals per half hour.
Wow.
And really go into depth on insects, butterflies, reptiles. So we're going to get real natural history on HRN.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, we're really happy to have him on board.
That's so cool.
So we will be back with the Q Report in 5 minutes, and we'll be back on the main course
next Sunday.
Thanks, Steve.
Looking
thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everyone, for coming, and thanks to our sponsor,
Sutton Place Frame Shop.